Welcome to the Disruptor Series podcast, Adweek's agency podcast of the year. Every episode, we listen to and learn from people who are disrupting business, culture, and life. Here's your host, Rob Schwartz, CEO of TBWA Shy Day New York.
All right, well, thank you for tuning in. Our guest today is an author, professor, graphic designer, digital marketer, and filmmaker. Please welcome Douglas Davis.
Thank you so much for having me. Brooklyn in the building.
Well, welcome to the Disruptor Series podcast.
Thank you.
Now, I like what you say on your website, which is that you're a, quote, digital marketer, freelance creative, design educator, who... Well, that depends on what day. So what are we today?
Wow. Well, today I'm the chair of the BFA in Communication Design at New York City College of Technology. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's known as City Tech. It's not City College, even though it's a part of CUNY. It's not Brooklyn College, even though it's at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. But we are the only, first and only, I'll say, accredited communication design program within CUNY. Hmm. And that means in a very short period of time that basically we offer the same degree as if you were to go to Pratt or Parsons in terms of like on paper. It's accredited by the same people. In terms of the experience, the challenge is that we're about 4 to 5 times larger than they are with maybe a fraction of the resources because we're public. So there's a little bit of tension there. But that's who I am today.
All right, good. We're going to get into all that because, as I was telling you earlier, I spent some time in Douglas Davis land, which is incredible. And I thought we would try to tackle, you know, your three big initiatives. You've got your film, you've got your book, and you've got your class.
Yeah.
So let's get into the film.
Let's do it.
Imported from Brooklyn.
Imported from Brooklyn.
So this is very interesting. So it's the story of a legendary designer, Tony DeSpina.
Yeah.
And he was all part of this kind of Herb Lubalin studio.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, you tell us a little bit about how this all happened.
Well, you know, it's a long story, but I'm going to try to make it interesting. But I met Tony when he was one of my professors at Pratt Institute. So just to rewind a little bit, I'm from South Carolina. I was born and raised there.
Oh, we're going to get into all that.
But I went to Hampton University undergraduate and studied graphic design there. And then I thought I needed a little bit more time. I thought I needed a little bit more polish and believe that, like, though I had, you know, Smithsonian Institution internships and I worked at Disney and I did a NASA microgravity internship. So I graduated with a resume, but I thought, you know what, I need a little bit more time. So
you graduated with some rocket science, but you're like, well, maybe I need a little more polish.
Yeah.
All right.
That microgravity stuff, which again, I don't understand. We have to sort of become experts on a couple of things really quickly until we move on to the other thing.
Right.
But I applied to Pratt, and I got in. It was the only graduate school I applied to. Actually, Hampton was the only undergraduate school I applied to. But
100% conversion
100%,
twice.
Which
that's
is
pretty
good. Crazy. Or it's pretty crazy. But I think in meeting Tony at Pratt, it was amazing because he had this reputation. It definitely preceded him. And meeting him there, you know, you could hear him even if you weren't in his class. He was yelling and, you know, ripping paper and things of that sort. But you knew he was a legend. You knew he worked with Herb Lubalin and Tom Carnese. And funny enough, after I graduated from Pratt, this was 2000. So from 98 to 2000. I was also teaching at the same time, so I had a bit of a dual career. Mm. So I'm bouncing around different agencies as well as just freelance, as well as I started teaching a class or two on the side. And I have to say, just in terms of people, just about Tony, every single class that I asked him to come to speak to my students, every single thing that I was asking him to give his time to, which he didn't have to because his commitment to me was done in 2000 when I graduated.
Right.
But I can look back and now it's 2020, Rob, and every single year, every single time since I graduated, he's been there.
Wow.
And I'm really thankful for his influence, but it was just really amazing to be around and to watch him work.
Well, yeah. So let's maybe set a little context here. So Lubalin Studios, so in the mid-70s, you know, this was a very happening place.
Very happening.
So kind of a, what they dubbed the anti-Swiss school. So if you think about clean Helvetica, these guys were on the other side of it.
Very absolutely.
Kind of, you know, sort of like human form type. I always remembered the one Lou Ballin image of, they had, I think it was a poster or a book on beards.
Yes.
And the illustration of the beard, but the type actually made the beard, right?
Yeah.
It's like very kind of interesting human forms. And then just, you know, maybe some other things for folks to conjure in their minds. The Lou Ballin studio did the legs.
Right.
Packaging.
Absolutely.
Dr. Brown's.
Absolutely.
PBS, Channel 13. And they may or may not know the Sound of Music. There was a kind of interesting.
Absolutely. That typography.
Scripty, whipty, seraphy stuff. And then I read something this morning, which I thought was really cool, is that the IBM logo, that kind of digitized logo that we all kind of just see now and take for granted, that almost looks like Venetian blinds. Mm. This was based on the Lou Ballin graph type. I read that this morning.
So Paul Rand was influenced.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Go figure, huh?
That is pretty awesome.
So they, so this kind of happening studio in the 70s, and then, and again, as you tell the story, an importer from Brooklyn, this immigrant guy, Tony, he gets there.
Yeah, which was pretty wonderful, just the fact that he immigrated here from South Brooklyn, he said, and he had a lot more ambition than he had money.
Mm.
And he wanted to go to Pratt, where I met him, actually.
Right, right.
But he didn't have enough money, so he went to City Tech, which was back then New York City Community College. Mm. Again, this is long before me. If I wasn't a student of this stuff, I'd not know it. Or if I didn't meet him and then, you know,
right,
start to ask him questions, I'd have no idea.
And what was it about his story that attracted you?
Well, truthfully, just looking at the way he worked, we were all in awe.
Hmm.
Just the fact that this signature style, that Spencerian script, the fact that it came out of his hand, and the fact that we could watch him think on paper.
Hmm.
So, you know, the Pratt format is that you consult with a master, right? So there's 12 of us, and we've done all our work. We're coming in, and we're showing it to him one by one. So there's harsh critiques.
Right.
And I'm so thankful for that. But I think what really interested me about him was that I could see him thinking as it was happening on paper. And so where a lot of people were really intimidated, I was like, this is amazing. I don't care how much he yells. Like, I want to be here. And so just in watching it develop almost as like a photograph, just right in front of your eyes, and
right,
seeing how much patience and time and how many times that he had done and developed this style, so much so that he didn't necessarily need all the tools and protractors and French curves and things of that sort. Not to say he didn't use any of that, but there was no way I could do almost like his worst sketch and to just see how much he had invested in it and became a master of it. So to sit there, to study with, to watch develop that right in front of you, that's what always drew me in and drew me to him.
And by the way, this is drawing type,
literally custom
pencil
designed
on tracing paper.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the times where he would say, you know, Herb couldn't draw to save his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Tom Carnes was there, who also went to City Tech. But Tony would learn to execute their sketches. And that's how he became a master. And so the fact that when they were doing avant-garde, and after they did this, if you're a real student, if you're a real art director, you know avant-garde and that typeface and what they've done with the magazine. But it started out as a masthead, and then from there they would always finish the characters.
Mm.
And they would also draw the alternate characters so that the art directors would have a little bit of flexibility. When you were setting some type, you could actually have a lowercase a with a swash that went to the left, or you could have another one where the swash went to the right, or you could have this piece that you could add to the different characters so that, again, my layout with the same type looks different from your layout.
Oh, we need to get back to that. We're in deep in type nerd land.
You're welcome if you're listening. You feel it.
So, all right. So you've worked with this guy. He's your professor. You're inspired by him. You're making stuff with him. He's critiquing you. And then, at a certain moment, you decide, wait a minute. There's a story that needs to be told. I think he was celebrating his 50th anniversary in the business or what have you.
He's actually retiring after 50 years at Pratt.
Oh, okay. So you're like, okay, there's a story here. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the pitch?
Ooh.
Because I read something fun about
the
this.
The absolute worst day in my life, I thought, you know what? I think that this is absolutely the right story to tell. So by this time, I'm a professor at New York City College of Technology, City Tech. Been there for years at that point, freelancing on the side. And I think to myself, you know what? I think it's time to raise our profile. I think, you know, they just built this new space for us. We are upgrading our offering to a BFA. There are some people who have graduated from here that if I didn't know them personally in terms of what they've contributed to the field, then I would have no idea and we would basically be invisible at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, Rob. We're at the literal
most iconic place.
Invisible. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to write some strategy. I'm going to inform and advise the current interim chair. And this is what I think would help us to raise their profile. We should absolutely sort of bank and build our brand off of Tony's story.
Yeah, interesting.
And wrote a whole strategy. And we had a series of meetings. So we get through this dean who is not necessarily with us, but we've convinced him to go and get us a meeting with the president and the provost and himself. So that morning, I had this weird interaction with my Uber driver. And it just felt like some sort of weird energy. And I was kind of off, but I was like, you know what, we're going to go sell this thing and like move us forward. So I go in and I start my pitch. I have everything designed and I show a picture of Tony in his younger days. So you see this guy, he's got this black, huge beard. He looks like a madman, to be honest with you.
Not like a hipster?
Madman. Okay. Like nothing like what we see and sort of appreciate as like this Brooklyn style. So I'm showing them that. We had this teaser because we had started to shoot and interview him. Mm. So I knew the story. I knew what it would be in terms of how it would play if you didn't know him. I knew that there was something there.
Right.
But we had some outtakes and he curses sometimes. So we did this really funny little short where he's talking and he's like, oh, fuck, you know, cut that out. And so we beep these things.
Right.
So I'm in this like 1970s wood panel, old school boardroom where the president of the college is there, the provost and the dean, and Tony's cursing. He looks like a madman. And like every single thing that I'm saying in terms of, well, he's from Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a global brand. It doesn't matter where you go. You don't even have to associate it with New York. Everyone knows. And they're like, ah, Brooklyn's time is ended. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I'm like, well, he's probably the most visible and famous alumnus who graduated from here. He's done things that you and your family know.
Right.
And then I start going through that. You know, we already have those stories. And I'm like, what? So every single point I'm bringing up, it gets killed. So I leave that meeting thinking, I lost my mojo. I had my pitch jacket on and everything, one of these jackets from Holland Esquire. It's like fire, right? I walk in.
By the way, what you guys can't see is a very cool suit that Douglas is wearing. So
thank you. But like I walk in and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to get this. I've done this many times. And we walk out and there was nothing that was even remotely heard, much less successful. Mm. So there were a couple more meetings where the same dean, who I was about to jump over the table and like, while we're there in the meeting, because he was with us until he wasn't. And he wasn't when we were in front of people. But either way, he comes to our faculty meeting and people want to flip over the table. I'm like, oh, it's not me, it's him. So fast forward, I'm now maybe, 3 months later, I'm elected chair of the program and I just proceed to do every single thing that they tried to kill.
Wow.
So that's how we got it in the light of day. But even then, we needed to sort of prove, even though we knew we had something good. So we started to submit it to all the award shows. Mm. We submitted it to film festivals. And a year later, very first day of the semester, I get a cart and I put 10 awards on it. And I wheel it into the president's office, that same conference room that I had the worst meeting in my life.
That's great.
And so that's how we got here. Yeah. So if you're watching, I hope that you can check out Imported from Brooklyn. It's actually on YouTube.
Yeah.
So if you search for the 2020 Be Free Awards, it's there, Imported from Brooklyn.
And Imported from Brooklyn, just that phrase itself, he referenced something that it was from a campaign.
Yeah.
I couldn't find where it was from.
I couldn't either, but he said it was a beer and it was maybe like 40 to 45 years old. And again, you can't tell because his style is timeless.
It's timeless. Yeah, it's amazing.
You cannot tell.
It's amazing. Very early in my career, the agency I worked at worked on the Dr. Brown's
campaign.
Did? Yeah, and the line, though, was imported from the old neighborhood. So not as good as imported from Brooklyn, but pretty good. All right, good. Well, that's the film. I think it's good, and it's worth watching. And I think you, if you don't know Lou Ballant's studio and you don't know Tony, I think it's worth watching because I'm seeing this Spencerian type everywhere, and these guys were masters at it. You know,
masters. He's the best in the world.
Yeah. So the next thing is your book.
Yeah.
And this was really interesting. The book, Creative Strategy and the Business of Design. And as I was reading it, what really struck me, and I don't know if you wrote this or just struck me, it sounds like something you would say, which is simply designers need to know more than design.
Yeah.
I mean, how did this idea come about? Because it's a very pragmatic book. And there's a lot we should unpack here because I think a lot of people get into our business, get into the design business. They get obsessed with creative. And your book is really about, be obsessed about creative, but also learn some of this other stuff that we like to call business.
Right.
So how did this all happen?
Well, I learned a lot of what's in the book from losing. And I say that because I started in the business, and my first job was in digital advertising. This was back 1999. I had just 1 year at Pratt Institute under my belt, and I was found and hired by Juno Online Services. This is back when you had like dial-up internet and like you had email clients, and the ads popped up in the client, right? So think about that. Again, 99, okay? So
pre-Y2K.
Pre-Y2K, right? And I'm entering the business in a medium that was just emerging, obviously, and in emerging in a way that I'm at Pratt Institute. I'm studying with people like Tony DeSpina, like world-class, world-famous people who helped to establish the field, and none of them had worked in digital. So there was this lack of respect or even understanding of what it was because it's just emerging. So I was found and hired. I entered there. That's where we started. I learned to leverage the 24-hour workday. So we had a team in India, and we're all in New York in Times Square. And over the next couple of months, actually, I think it was a calendar year, the dot-com recession happened. So I was the first one to get laid off just in the round of successions of my friends.
Welcome to advertising.
Right? So from there, it was about a year and 9 months. I'm eating lunch every day in Fort Greene Park. I'm spending every night applying to every single job on the job boards. I would call people at 1 a.m., Rob, and leave them my contact info so that in the morning, my voice would be the first one that they would hear. But I was also folding sweaters at the Gap because it got crazy.
Buddy, the hustle was real.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm calling them back on my 15-minute break.
Oh.
But after the economy comes back, it was a year and 9 months of just freelancing, folding sweaters and doing all that. The economy comes back. I land a job at Condé Nast. So I'm doing digital again. And from there, I go to Essence. And then I break into advertising. So I'm at JWT. And I'm working on HSBC. And it was really interesting because everything that I learned from writing my own contracts and doing that freelance while things were very, very difficult, I then used when it was time at JWT. Because after about 3 months of coming to work bored every day because I'm just setting type, even though I'm loving the people who I'm working with, very first job in advertising, I realized that one day when this account manager runs into the conference room, she's like, the client wants a website. And I'm like, I know how to do that. And everyone looks at me because I'm the youngest one in the agency at that point. From there, I proceed to tell the CEO and the creative director all the money we left on the table for all the projects that I was watching while I was bored, just setting type. From there, they hired me to be an ACD, and I launched the digital arm within Briard Communications, which was the specialized agency within JWT. They're not there anymore. But all of this sort of came about because with my education from Pratt and from Hampton University, undergraduate in graphic design, communications design master's degree at Pratt, and my experience in the digital advertising space, the design space, promotions, as well as just this small amount of time within digital advertising, I realized that I could see the opportunities that people who were older than me couldn't see because they didn't have that experience. So in 3 months, I'm ACD now, and I'm using everything that I used to survive as a freelance designer in order to build this digital arm of, you know, this advertising agency that I'm now in. I rebrand the agency. I'm hiring one of my friends from that first job at Juno, and we just hire a lot of people.
And by the way, how old are you at this time?
Gosh, I'm probably like 24, 25.
So you're essentially a punk.
Yes, exactly. I have no idea going on.
But what's interesting is that you're seeing holes. You're seeing the opportunity. And what I loved about your book was this concept that you have of seeing the whole picture. And you write about a very interesting story. I think this comes from your parents or your grandparents. Maybe talk about that story. Yeah, yeah, about you tell the story.
So my grandfather would listen to Rush Limbaugh every day at noon.
And could you just describe your grandfather a little bit?
You know, my grandfather, wow, man, I miss my grandfather, Ben Frank Davis. And we're from Lexington, South Carolina, very, very small town. Where I was born and raised, and they were sharecroppers. Mm. My grandma, Sarah Mae Davis, Ben Frank, my grandfather, they didn't finish the fifth, sixth grade, and yet the wisdom that they taught me in terms of how to survive, you know, I've learned more from them than I have from PhDs and creative directors. Even to this day, a lot of those lessons are with me. But the very first lesson, and in a sense, the whole reason that the book came about is that my grandfather's listening to freaking Rush Limbaugh.
Right. African-American sharecropper.
Not
exactly your portrait of a Rush Limbaugh listener. And again, why?
Why is really important. I asked my grandfather. Mm. I'm like, Granddaddy, like, don't you hear what he's saying? Like, why are you listening to this? And he didn't even hesitate. And he said, because I want to know what they think. And literally, I'm like 8 years old, Rob. I realized then, you know what? To think how they think, to do what we do, that's how you survive. So going back to the agency, things are going really well. I'm going as far as I can go, pretty much as fast as I can go with the education that I had. Mm-hmm. I'm now going from freelancer to ACD in 3 months. Mm-hmm. And yet, it was very difficult for me to justify what I really did believe was the right way to go creatively on our work, our digital work, because I didn't understand business. I didn't understand why we were in the room. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand strategy. So I'm falling back on my design and aesthetic vocabulary, and I'm arguing for things on the basis of the typeface. I'm arguing for things on the basis of the color. I'm arguing for the things, you know, based on the layout itself. And you know what, Rob? I'm right, actually. Yeah. And yet, every time, as you know, I'm being bested by people who speak a completely different language that I don't understand, because at Pratt, in many of the art schools, it was about making things pretty. Mm-hmm. And so we never even learned that there was this other side of things. And so I like to say in design schools and portfolio schools, we're taught to focus on the tactical parts of what should be larger strategic decisions. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you have someone who is versed in the candy, I like to say, of, you know, different typefaces and how to do things custom. And you probably also have some technical experience, mm-hmm. and you can, you know, make your ideas come to life. And yet we have no idea, because it wasn't taught to us in the context of why we were in the room in the first place. Business, marketing objectives, metrics, none of that.
And by the way, I think this is the magic of the book, because but I think what people can't really appreciate is that you are a student of all the candy.
Candy.
And
absolutely.
I think the magic of the book is you can be the most aesthetic designer out there, but you're also, you know, and you're going to have to, you know, you can love this candy, but you're going to have to know the broccoli to sell the candy.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the power of the book.
That's really it. And eventually, after our 18-month run, I started to lose battles because I couldn't speak that language of business. And it was funny because we were also freelancing on the side as well as running this new capability. And I leave a lunch meeting on our freelance practice and we win the Subway digital business, like at lunch. And I'm like, oh, shit. Like, I got a full-time job and we're doing Deutsche Bank, we're doing Ruby Tuesday, we're doing, gosh, we're doing HSBC. Like, there's so many different things. And over on this other hand, we have this Subway Digital business. And so it's weird because we had my creative partner and I had a meeting with this new agency who wanted to enter into New York City. They were actually from Boston. They're gone now. But they were just entering in, and the Subway Digital account was their first.
Wow.
So they're like, hey, so what do you want? You know, you guys could be the creatives here with us. And I was like, and this is the first thing that popped into my mind. I said, I want $100,000 and no boss. Like, I want $100,000 and no boss.
I'm not sure you asked for enough.
I know. But I'm a little kid.
Right.
I thought, like, what's the largest number that I could ask for? Mm. I'm like maybe 25, 26 at that point. They say done. And I'm like, oh, snap. So now I'm ACD at this agency that we just start. And I'm also, you know, I have the $100,000 and no boss.
Right.
My partner bounces immediately. The creative director at JWT is yelling and screaming at me because, why didn't you tell me your partner was going to leave? I was like, he's like, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to preserve the partnership. He's like, well, what do you want? I was like, I want $100,000 and no boss. And he's like, he laughs. So I give him my 2 weeks because I have what I wanted.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to be able to work both.
It would have been awesome, but I'm not that old yet. So I leave and we go there, but I stumble into a strategy session.
Mm.
And I have to say, Rob, that's when I was like, oh, this is that stuff that keeps beating me.
Mm.
Whenever I run up against the end of my ability to explain why this is the right way to go and why it definitely will work. So from there, I realized, you know what? I need to set out to actually mix what I do, the candy, with the why, with the business strategy. So I'm like, okay, where do I do that? So I start searching. I apply, and this is crazy because I already have a master's degree. I already have freelance career. I'm bouncing around in different places.
But you had
places.
A master's degree in serifs.
Well, you know, kind of, because it was about making things pretty. I'll give you that. So I go to NYU for the integrated marketing program, and that's where they both came together.
Mm.
So the book is part story. So if you read the first page of every chapter, it's the story as to why this is even going to be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that my audience as creative people were not taught this thing that I had to go through, and sort of really understand from the standpoint of not, you know, getting business, or else they wouldn't listen. So adding that story to put it in context, to speak directly to the creatives.
Oh, it sucks you right in.
And I hope that, you know, there's quite a lot of value there for people, and that you don't have to, it's much cheaper than going to NYU.
Well, I think what's great is that, you know, you were hitting the wall. You were hitting the no.
I really was.
And you could not articulate what it would take to get over that no to the yes, which
right.
I think was very powerful. And, you know, people often, you know, ask me, they're like, well, how can I advance in my career? You know, creatives want to know how they can become ACDs, CDs,
right.
and on and on and on. And I, to me, this concept that you have to become an enterprise creative, meaning that, yes, you have to obsess on the creative, but you have to know why. The enterprise, you have to think about things horizontally, not just in your narrow vertical.
Absolutely.
And I think what this book, which is, you know, very powerful, and it says right in the title, Creative Strategy and the Business of Design, gives you, I don't know, it gives you that MBA, you know, in whatever, 200 pages. So.
And I want to make a point, because in breaking into advertising, but approaching it and starting as a designer, I felt like that sort of gave me a bit of an edge because of the fact that at Pratt, it really is about the craft. That was something that I really understood. And again, like people with like Tony DeSpina, it really was, hey, you approach this thing from this perspective. And yet, you know, back in the day, there wasn't a difference necessarily between advertising and design. It was all creativity. It was all an outlet. And I remember one of the professors who were on my staff, he was telling me about that Burnback book.
Mm-hmm.
Really awesome. He actually mentioned, and I did not know this, but he mentioned that Burnback and Paul Rand,
right,
were partners for a little bit.
Right.
And that blew my mind.
Right.
But I say all that because creative strategy obviously speaks to our businesses as creators, as disruptors, but, you know, as admin, mm-hmm. right, and women. But the business of design, you know, you could read that and think, oh, this is about how do you write your proposal or how do you structure this meeting or, you know, that sort of thing. But it's not really about that. It's really about, as you were saying, understanding what's happening beyond the creative team, regardless of mm-hmm. what you're doing. Because what we do as creative people, it's an outlet. We're problem solving, regardless mm-hmm. of what the purpose mm-hmm. is. And this is sort of mirroring my progression as a designer, but who could also do the digital stuff and moved into advertising itself, but I could also teach it and then learning strategy and then I'm writing about it. I realized about myself that I'm just an artist, and truthfully what I'm looking for is an outlet. Mm-hmm. And that might be words, that might be shoestrings, that might be fashion, that might be advertising, it might be an app, it might be a website. It doesn't really matter. But if you don't understand why are you in the room? And why did the people who hired you hire you, mm-hmm. right? Then from there, you can figure out how to get to yes, like you were saying.
Yeah, well, I think that is the power of this book. And I think just learning the language of business, because it is learning a language.
Yeah, it's a completely different language.
That'll
really a different help. Side of the brain.
Yeah, no, but I think that'll help anybody in our business, especially, you know, if you're a rising creative person, I think... book is a must.
There are several places in the book actually where I put my email address. So if you do happen to pick it up, please, you know, reach out. I always tell people who sort of post on social, hey, I got your book. I'm like, hey, let me know if it sucks. So let me know if it sucks.
It does not suck.
Reach out.
All right. The third piece we're going to talk about, we talked about your film. We talked about your book. Let's talk a little bit about your teaching. So you're teaching now in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, I read this piece that you had written, you know, in conceiving your class, and you'd mentioned one of the fathers of disruption, Jean-Marie Drew's contemporary, Mr. Clay Christensen from Harvard.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if you could maybe just talk a little bit about why disruption and how it relates to your teaching.
Yo, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned Clay.
Just passed away recently.
Yeah, that was... Gosh, just learning disruptive theory from him was really awesome. I took one of those Harvard Business Online, actually two of those classes, and one of the first ones was disruptive strategy. So it definitely felt personal whenever he passed away. So rest in peace. But just in terms of disruption, it's interesting because, as you mentioned, I'm a professor now. That's, you know, my fixed income. I'm still on the side with the Davis Group, handling different projects and things of that sort. But I'm a professor, and I realize that I'm not of the ivory tower. Mm. And I learn and understand that every day. So rewinding back to that terrible meeting, it was because they couldn't hear me. I'm from the advertising world. I'm from the design world. I'm from the strategy world, but I'm from the private sector, even though I'm a professor. Mm. And I think disruption in terms of teaching, but also in terms of where my position is now, it's disruptive when you come into the ivory tower, you don't have a PhD, but you have results. Mm. Because as you know, Rob, if you don't show and prove every day, it doesn't matter what you did before, what are you going to do now for the client? How are you going to move the needle now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think taking that thought process from the agency world, that fire, you're thrown into the middle and you got to figure it out. Those new business pitches, you know, trying to figure out how to grow that business or keep it or defend it or win it back or whatever you're doing, that taught me something. It taught me how to survive. And I think entering into the ivory tower, being around all these PhDs where it's not really about money because everyone is making the same amount according to your title. It's all about power and influence. We were saying earlier that it's basically Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is like the faculty meeting, like in 8 seasons. But I think ultimately in my experience now, my thought process is disruptive, but in a different context. And that's why it's disruptive. I think it's the same thing with in my head, knowing that, you know what, I'm losing. And I know what I'm talking about, but I don't know how to win in this context. let me, instead of learning at the time more Flash and more action script, which is surprise, not here anymore.
Right.
Instead of going back downstream, you know what? Let me learn the strategy. Let me figure out what the people who are making the decisions understand so that I can then inject creativity into business.
Right.
Like Tibor Kalman says. So I think my model has been to take something out of context and then introduce it in a completely different place. So it's not necessarily...
disruption. Yeah, yeah. What I love about what you're saying is you seem to have this ability to take book smart and put it on a collision course with street smart.
I hope so.
And that is what makes something unique to, you know, what your students are going to get from you.
In all honesty, I've had to sort of decide at different points what I was going to completely disregard concerning, I'm in this ivory tower and this is what they're asking for. These are the incentives. And this is completely opposite of my professional viability, which I must protect at all costs because I have nothing to say to a digital native when I walk into the room if I am not valuable to a client in the boardroom, period.
Yeah.
So how do I bring in the same standards?
And by the way, are your students demanding that? I mean, are people walking into your classroom saying, hey, I need some, you know, pragmatic stuff here. I can't just know theory.
You know what? They don't know what they don't know. And yet they're walking out into an industry that I didn't walk out into. And so I keep on the forefront of my mind when I talk to my staff that our students are immigrants. Many of them are the first people in their families to go to college, much less speak English. Even
kind of like Tony, by the way.
Exactly
right?
Like Tony.
Right.
Exactly. So therefore, we can't really be in just the candy business.
Right.
That's not possible for these students who probably cobble together money from people in other countries, their grandparents and aunts, in order for them to actually afford the tuition, which is a fraction of what you would actually pay if you were at a private school.
Right.
Therefore, it has to, on day one, have no lag time between the way you introduce problems to them in here and the way that their creative director or boss or art director is going to introduce problems to them in the wild.
Right.
And that's where I guess I'm doing the exact same thing where the standards need to be a reflection of what the industry is instead of a shadow of what the industry was when we were there. And so I'm watching everything, every detail, but the students themselves don't know what they're going out into. And I think that's where the responsibility comes in for us. And in some ways, I really do believe that academia and industry have to merge. They have to blend because in design school, they don't teach you business. And in when I went to business school, they don't teach you how to inspire designers.
Can't you just give them the book?
You know what? Check it out. But I mean, you know, you've been in situations where the client is vague. It's because they don't know.
Right.
Or you get a brief that's the size of like a novel.
Yeah.
And it's because no one was taught, even though their experience and education made them a professional so that we can be on the same team to service this client, but it never taught us to talk to each other. And so now we're here, the client expects everyone involved to be strategic, and we can't even speak the same language.
Right.
That's a problem.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sure it's probably as revolutionary as Birnbach putting the copywriter and the art director together.
Absolutely.
In some ways.
Which you learned from the designer, Paul Rand.
I know, which was so, that blew my mind.
I know, it's amazing. It's just amazing. So we talked a little bit about your journey. I think maybe one question on your journey I would have is, were you always drawn to this? I mean, did you grow up drawing? You know,
I did.
So, I mean, what part was innate and what part did you discover?
So I was one of those kids in class that was like the class clown. I did not pay attention because I was bored and I could crack jokes with you, totally not pay attention, do no homework at all whatsoever. And when the teacher's like, well, what did I just say? I could spit back verbatim exactly what the teacher said. And so I wasn't being engaged.
Right.
I'm bored. I'm acting out. And it was so funny. This is back when sagging first started. So I'm sagging my pants. I'm real cool. And the teacher's like, pull your pants up. And I ankled myself. In class. And so I'm in school suspension. But I'm drawing all day in in-school suspension because I'm an art student. And I was like, this is awesome. So I'm thinking to myself, this is sort of where my behavior changed because I had an outlet at that point.
You found something.
I found something. And so I just channeled it all into art. But the crazy thing about how I grew up and how I got into this is that, you know, being down south, there's still, even today, like so much racial tension. And I never had one conversation with a guidance counselor about college.
Wow.
Never one time. If I didn't know about whether it's South Carolina State because my cousin and my aunt went there, if I didn't know because my church or because like my family took us on vacation every year and then we made it a point to stop into the local African-American site to learn something.
Right.
If I didn't have that education after the education at home,
right,
I would have had no idea who I was. And so it's really interesting that 11th grade summer, again, no conversations about college. I say to myself, you know what? If I don't go to college, I want it to be because I chose not to go versus I couldn't go. So I choose to go to summer school on my own. I take an extra math. I take my extra foreign language. And I take the SAT like three times to get the best score. Fast forward, I've already graduated high school. Still have no plans. I still have not even applied to college. I'm doing some community service with the Urban League. And I did not know that the people I was working with, because I stumbled into a conversation in another room. I didn't know that the people who I was volunteering with, one of those gentlemen, was the vice president of recruitment admissions at Hampton University, which I had never heard of. So I stumbled onto that conversation and like, well, if you have the college requirements, you should apply. And at that point, I had them. And I
so you didn't even know to go to art school?
No, nothing.
What design was?
Nothing. All I did was draw and stop going to in-school suspension as a result of drawing.
Wow. And by the way, you couldn't even say, hey, someone, you know, put together this album cover.
No idea. And that's a really interesting point because when you're at the point of possibility, like I was, the people who are tasked with planting the seeds of possibility, like my guidance counselor,
right,
or like my mom, or like my aunts and, or my uncles, if those people either don't know or won't tell you what a path is, they weren't exposed to it. It's as if you weren't taught what engineering was, but you're driving over a bridge every day to go to where you need to go. You benefit from it.
Right.
But it's invisible to you.
Right.
And if you think about what we do, every UI, every website, everything from the cradle to the grave, I always like to say, you know, from these pharmaceuticals that you got in the hospital to the brochure that you're going to pick out your casket from, and everything in between was designed.
That's the ultimate customer journey, by the
way. Ultimate customer journey, like you've been beginning to the end. Lifetime value, that's probably where that came from.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, if those people don't know or are not interested in helping you find your way, then like I was rudderless. And so I finally apply. I do get in. But I'm going there. I think I'm going there for fashion merchandising.
Wow.
So my mom packs up all my stuff. We drive 6 hours to Virginia. She looks at everything that she's paying for on the way out, and she leaves. She comes back 4 years later to my graduation. But so she leaves. So I do everything I need to do, and I'm there. I go to registration, and they're like, well, we phased that program out.
Wow.
So I'm there.
Oh, my God.
I'm accepted. They phased the program out. So I said, okay, well, my fashion interest was only a symptom of my art interest anyway. I'll do this graphic design thing and photography. So I've never done that
literally
before.
Literally stumbled into it.
I literally stumbled into
it.
Even though in my little small town, my Lexington Public Schools, we had a wonderful art program. And so I had had some experience
exposure
at that point. But I had no idea that like that was a path. Like you could get paid doing that. I didn't even know I was going to college. So I'm the professor who didn't have any plans to go to college. And what's even more interesting is that, so I go to Hampton University, it's HBCU. I'm learning graphic design, very small program, maybe 15 of us. We're all African-American. And all of my design teachers were white. And it was a wonderful experience because I learned a lot about not only like how to really channel and like sort of have a level of work ethic in my craft. I learned work ethic from, you know, my grandparents, just watching them. But I knew very early on that either I want to get paid with my head, because I see people getting paid with their back and I'm not the strongest. So I need to outsmart. I need to get paid with thinking and not necessarily like physical labor. So again, I'm a really little kid reasoning that stuff out. But I'm there and I'm learning work ethic and I'm learning it from these designers at an HBCU, but they're all white. So I'm not even thinking about any of that, by the way. I'm just thinking about the work.
Right.
So then I go to Pratt and I'm learning from professors, best in the world, who are all white. I'm not even thinking about that. I'm thinking about how do I get the best book. I'm thinking about like, yo, this is a bunch of competition. Can I even do it? So I end up going to NYU and I'm learning strategy from the best in the world. They're all white. Again, I'm not thinking about that.
Right.
And yet I couldn't see myself in any of those places. And I wasn't looking for me. I was looking to be the best at what I was doing.
Right.
And yet I then became a design professor. I became a strategy professor. I became a strategist.
It became the disruption you needed to see in the world.
Right? That's so crazy.
That is amazing.
But that's my origin story.
Yeah, so, no, it's great. And by the way, I think what I read was that Lou Ballin actually hired a lot of African-American, or at least the first few African-American designers. So maybe your connection to Tony was somehow you know, connected to fate. Well, that's amazing. Well, wow.
I had fun.
That's amazing. Well, you're on the hook for one more thing. We ask for one piece of advice. Now, I'm going to lead the witness because I love what you said, which is doubt is a dragon that won't shut up. Something that you said, which is a great line, but give a rising star or even a CMO, give them a piece of advice.
You know, I can remember like it was yesterday taking my first tour of Four Times Square when Condé Nast was there. I'm on the 17th floor. I'm like fresh off of a year and 9 months of like eating lunch in the park and folding sweaters at the Gap because of the dot-com recession. And they're showing us in this beautiful open plan sort of office in this high rise in Times Square where the different things are. This is account and this is whatever. And all of a sudden, to the left of me, this lady stands up and says, "Get out! You're fired! Get out!" So right in front of me, somebody gets fired. So the fear of God is in me. Every time I walk into this building, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to do something wrong today. I'm going to get fired. I'm going to get fired. I know I'm going to get fired. So I'm clenched up. And I'm there for 7 months, freelance. And there was so much stress and pressure on me because of that experience. Again, I wasn't even getting fired, but that stayed with me. So then I go to Essence, which was a wonderful experience. These two were right next to each other back then. I could look out of Four Times Square into 1540 Broadway and literally started working there. And I realized that one of my art directors there was also yelling at different points. And it was interesting because I didn't understand that I wasn't the problem. I didn't realize why the yelling was happening, but I was so afraid that I was going to get fired again that it was very difficult to actually do the best work, even though I sort of scratched out the best work that I could. And then I remember freelancing at another place, and the art director, when I walk in to show what I was doing, starts yelling. And then I say, "First of all, this is my last day," yelling at him. "Now we can come in here and talk about what I came in to talk about." So to any young designer or art director listening to this, the advice that I would give is that if your boss, if your creative manager is yelling, it's because they don't understand how to manage people or communicate, and they're insecure. It's them. It's not you. And so I think if I knew that before I learned to stand up for myself, I think I could have had better work, or I think my headspace
yeah.
would have been focused on why I was in the room versus am I going to get yelled at or am I going to get publicly embarrassed again? You know, is it me? Like, am I doing this? And so, again, if you're listening and you're a junior or if you're yelling at people, I would challenge you to learn how to communicate, learn how to articulate what it is that you're trying to convey through yelling, because it's not working. My uncle was a command sergeant major in the military, and he would always say, very soft spoken, he would always say, if you have to yell, you've already lost control. His voice would never rise above a certain amount, and he was always in control. And so to the people out there, if you're listening right now and you need a little bit of time and space to grow, it's not you. It's them.
All right, Mr. Davis, I'm leaving it there, man.
Bam.
You are an inspiration.
I hope so.
Fantastic. I think the film Imported from Brooklyn, go look at this. It's really just a wonderful, beautiful story. And I think this book, The Creative Strategy and the Business of Design, if you want to be an enterprise creative, you want to start selling more stuff, it's invaluable. It's really a powerful book.
Thank you.
And you know what? Take his class. Why don't they take your class?
Let's do it. Come through.
All right, Douglas. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptor Series podcast, Adweek's agency podcast of the year. Craving more disruption? Visit us at tbwashydayny.com.